This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
I love that last part of that bio. That got me really inspired. The world peace part. I like that. Okay. One second. And I also learned while Sharon was reading that, I always see when I go visit my teachers and someone reads their bio, the teacher always kind of looks kind of bored or something. And I'm like, huh, what is that? And I realize they're just, I mean, if they were me, it's because you're trying to like have your bio read and like not make eye contact with anybody. Wow. Yes.
I was just thinking that now that you've solved world peace, you can go on to world hunger next.
We already produce enough calories for everyone on the planet. It's just a distribution problem. So that, and that's hard. That, I think that has to do with the peace. But if, for more of that, come to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Los Gatos every Sunday, and we talk about such matters and how they relate to meditation. Anyway, so on to the meditation part. Who among us has been here for other classes in this series? Would you raise your hand to let me know? So you've been to some of the previous classes. And am I speaking loud enough? Good. I have to change my meditation voice into my presenter voice. So I had a very particularly meditative day, too, so I'm kind of soft and quiet. Okay, so let's review just a little bit. Who remembers any of the previous factors of enlightenment? Anybody? Dave, what was one?
Mindfulness.
We got investigation.
Effort,
okay. Mindfulness, investigation, effort.
Equanimity.
Ooh, I love it. Not yet, but it is one, I think, in there. Okay. Any more? So we're on number mindfulness, investigation, effort, and now joy. Okay, this is fabulous. All right, so I'm going to kind of teach this class intuitively. I have a number of ideas of what we might do, but I didn't quite know what would work for all of us, so we'll just see where to go with it. So in the way I relate to the material that this class, because I'm ordained in a Mahayana Buddhist tradition, which embraces, so a lot of the seven factors of enlightenment come from a Pali text, the Samyutta Nikaya, if you're concerned with all of that stuff, right? But what's cool is that, you know, they say, oh yeah, the Mahayana and the Hinayana, and some people are offended by either of these names, and I don't know, I don't want to get into that debate if I can help it in my whole life. But what they share is this basic path of how to cultivate concentrated, calm, abiding awareness. So in the way that I've been training this and the way I've been teaching a class on it recently, we deal with these seven factors of enlightenment or seven factors of awakening in terms of answers or antidotes to certain hindrances on the path of cultivating this deep abiding concentration. So those of you who have been here, have the previous teachers related them to their specific hindrances? What do you think? A little bit, some or not others? Maybe? Okay. So I thought we might review that a little bit just for fun, because then it gets us ramped up to, rather than kind of trying to hit the ground running at factor number four, you know, we can kind of ramp up a little bit. One text that most traditional Buddhist teachers always use a text, and then that gives us something to sit on so we can kind of riff and not have to make up the whole thing our own. So one text that I use is from an Indian master named Kamala Shila, and this is called the Bhava Marga, or the stages of meditation. And it's very similar to what is presented in the Samyutta Nikaya. And so he says that there, as you go through meditation, there are certain obstacles that arise at different stages. So Those of you who have meditated for a day or 30 years or something like that, what are some of the obstacles that arise for you? What do you think? What's an obstacle, Dave?
Physical discomfort.
Physical discomfort. Yeah. What's another obstacle to your meditation practice?
Sleepiness.
Sleepiness. Yeah. What else? Restlessness. Yeah. Did you say another word before I cut? Restless mind. Yeah. What else?
Distractions.
Something? Same thing. Others? Yes.
Some insights seem to come when they distract again.
Yeah, so, and this is a special one. I'm so glad you brought that up because it's one of my favorite ways to not meditate. And the Buddhist masters speak to this specifically. When a particularly virtuous thought comes up, which isn't your meditation object. And so it's a very seductive distraction, and yet still a distraction. And so there's a good discussion about how do you deal with that. Sometimes, if that's the only virtuous thought you've had all day, I like to just roll with it and like, you know. But if, you know, if you've been doing some virtue and then it comes up when you're supposed to be like watching your breath and it's like, hey, there's time for that later. So what else are some obstacles? Yes. Doubt. Yes, that's not tonight's obstacle, but the one coming in a few classes, I believe. Did you have your hand up back there? No. Any others? Rhiannon, what's your obstacle?
Sitting on the cushion.
Yeah, doing it, right? Just doing it.
Yeah,
actually. Yeah. So Master Kamala Shila says, this Indian master, his name means the fragrance of pure ethics, which I kind of like. So he says your first obstacle is called laziness, which means not sitting on the doggone cushion, right? And it's the first bar to being a meditator. If you can accomplish getting on the cushion, I say personally, like 5 days a week, 20 minutes a day, if you can accomplish that, you're now a stage one meditator. Yeah, and that's a big accomplishment. If we look around the world, getting to be a stage one meditator, your mind's distracted, you're snoozing half the time, but you got on the cushion 5 days a week, 20 minutes a day. That's 100 minutes a week. That's all it takes. 5 times 20. Yes, to be a stage one meditator, right? And then he says to be a stage two meditator, the obstacle in that text is called forgetting the instructions, which means your mind wanders to something else, right? So classically, they say, well, how do you decide what to meditate on? You know, because sometimes you want to meditate on these virtuous insights or something like that. So in ancient times, they would say you need a meditation mentor or a guide, and I think this is actually still pretty good advice if you can find somebody who seems authoritative to you. Like, I personally look for someone who's up on the sort of neuropsychological literature and also has some retreat time under their belt, and also knows a little bit about, has maybe mentored other people, and has had a mentor. Because not the same meditation objects won't always work for different people at different times, right? So it's nice to have somebody you can talk to, like, hey, this is coming up. So they give you this instruction, like today our instruction was watch the breath. Is that your primary meditation practice, watching the breath? Would you raise your hand to let me know? Okay, cool. And then does anybody do body scanning? This is another good old insight meditation, body scanning. Cool. Some others, like in the Gom Rim, they say like you can visualize a golden Buddha. That's a pretty cool one. Makes your mind calm if you like Buddhas. If not, you know, it probably makes you pretty agitated. But you would find this object, and then to be a stage two meditator, you have to stick to it. Now, you don't have to have good concentration. You just have to not completely forget the instructions for a long period of time, right? You know, sit there and only have gotten a minute on your object. You know, the ability to bring the mind back to the object makes you this, in this book, the stage two meditator. And I kind of like it because it lets me know sort of where I'm working. So then he says, to get to stage three and four, now we're starting to deal with the ways the mind gets distracted. And these are the first two of the five hindrances that you may have heard about in previous classes. Has anybody heard this term, the five hindrances? This is this early Buddhist, and then all the way through the history of Buddhism, everybody uses these, this terminology, five hindrances. So the first two are sensual desire, they say, kama something, right? And ill will, or sometimes they translate malice or anger or something like that. So sensual desire and malice or ill will. And has anybody ever had, so this can be actually, can drop you back down below a stage one meditator if you get them strong enough, right? Has anybody ever woken up, made the mistake of checking your email or answering the phone or something before you did your practice, and something just ticked you off so much that you couldn't actually get to the cushion that day? Yeah, so you were at stage four, but today, nope, sorry, you know, ill will. Or you made the mistake of going on the internet and some advertisement just hooked you, and you've got sensual desire, right? And the thing is, you know, sensual desire doesn't mean, let's not fall into this, there are a series of translations from like the late 1800s of Buddhist works that seem to say, you know, because they're influenced by our Christian history as a nation, you know, they seem to say that, like, kind of imply that sexual desire is the root of suffering, right? You know, what are the four noble truths? Well, it's truth number one, there's suffering. Truth number two, it has a cause, and it's desire. So don't think about men's or ladies or whoever you like. But it doesn't mean this. It means inappropriate desire. So in that case, it would be any kind of, you know, if you're thinking about this great business that you're going to put together to help the world when you're supposed to be meditating, this is a meditation hindrance of desire. Why? Because it's time to meditate, right? It's not time to plan out your business. So this is great, and there are, antidotes to each of these hindrances. The first one, the antidote to laziness, is you give yourself a pep talk, basically. It's like the pep talk meditation. So you would think about, what are the benefits of meditation? Does everybody know a benefit of meditation? Please tell me, what's a benefit that you know, Dr. I forget what your name is. Dr. Tracy.
Emotional
equanimity, right? So meditation has been shown. You know, meditation, prayer too, if you like prayer, you know, they have similar effects. Tai Chi can do it. Has been shown that, like, when rattling events come, you tend to get less rattled. Right? It changes your brain somehow. Really kind of cool. So if you were like, oh, do I meditate today or do I shop on eBay? You would remind yourself, oh, wait, I'm really going to need that emotional equanimity today, right? That's a pretty good one. Are there other benefits to meditation? Like things that you have noticed? What do you think? Is that the only one? What do you think, Willow? Yeah, so in ancient Buddhism, they say, let's see if I can remember the Pali for it. Your dhyana, your meditation, gives rise to more wisdom, and your wisdom fuels your ethics, which then in turn fuels your meditation, which then in turn fuels your wisdom, and they go around increasing each other. Right, so a good meditation actually makes you kinder. And if you want to know more about that, you can look up research at the Greater Good Center in Berkeley, and there's some nice stuff about how meditation and kindness are intertwined. I thought I saw a hand back here before you. Yes, please. Yeah, so meditation can actually cause joy. How? What a great segue into tonight's topic. Yeah, Dave. Meditation can improve your physical health, heart rate, oxygen absorption, all this kind of stuff. What else?
Just focus and become very efficient.
Yeah, focus, concentration, efficiency, creativity. So, like, my favorite one, you know, these thoughts, these wonderful, virtuous, inspiring thoughts are a result of meditation. You know, this is part of the benefit of it. Edie, did you? Yeah.
Yeah, I get a little insight into my mind health.
Yes, metacognitive awareness. Yeah, so cool. How about neurogenesis? Have you heard, or neurogenesis? Have you heard of this? This is, new studies are showing that meditators actually grow new brain cells and connections sort of more rapidly than non-meditators. So that's if you like brain cells, which I do, that's pretty cool. So now you have this ability, if you're feeling sort of, they call it lazy, but it could just be distracted, any of these things that don't get you on the cushion, you could give yourself a pep talk, right, and get yourself started. Now, what's cool about that one is it's a little bit similar to what we're going to talk about tonight, which we're not there yet. We're almost there. We're still in review time, which is a type of dullness that can infect your meditation once you're already meditating. So a very similar thing that we just did, if you have this laziness that you can't quite get on the cushion, you psych yourself up. Oh, wow. You know, has anybody, so a couple of people said, yes, they've done retreats like 3 day or 10 day or 21 day or 3 year or something like this, right? Something often happens if you're going to do a retreat, and I wonder if anybody's ever experienced this, right? You know, you book the 3 day retreat, you take time off of work, you put a vacation message on your email, whatever, and then the day before, all of this stuff that has to be done comes up, and you have like a minor emotional breakdown too, and then your tire goes flat. Has anybody ever experienced this? A little bit, yeah. In ancient times, they would say these are the Maras. These are actually demonic entities who don't want you to meditate. They know you're going to be happy, and the thing that demonic entities like the least is people being happy. I don't know if you buy that, but it does seem to happen, and it's very nice to know, because there can be, if this happens, maybe it wasn't for a retreat if you don't have that experience yet, but maybe you're going to Disneyland or something like that, and there was this great thing going to happen, and then all this stuff gets in the way, and there's this type of sinking. Ugh, I don't think I'm going to make it to the retreat. I've had students call for like classes that I was offering, you know, and they're coming way over in Sacramento, you know, and which is only really like 3 hours away or something, right? You know, and a couple hours before, you know, they were talking to me for 3 months. Oh, I'm so excited. Oh, here's my deposit for the, oh, this is going to be great. Do I need to bring anything? I'll bring my mat. Do I need to bring lunch? Oh, I got my place booked. And then, you know, 3 hours before, I don't think I'm going to make it, you know, and you can tell there's always this quality. Something comes up and there's this sinking. Oh. And if they would have remembered how stoked they were about the idea in the first place, you know, we can overcome all of that. But if we don't have a pep talk, or if we don't have some way to hone in on that feeling awesome about it, the sinking can overcome us. Okay, so this is how we deal with laziness, according to Master Kamala Shila. Then, if your mind gets, so we're in the initial phases of meditation. In later phases of meditation, they would say, you're no longer going to be swayed by sensual desire, quote-unquote sensual desire, and by agitation. So there comes a certain point. And has anybody ever experienced this? I mean, you don't have to be a long-term meditator. We all get these peak experiences in there, or maybe you're just emotionally mature. But you can get into a meditation and you can start to feel the glimmers of like what normally pulls you into a sensory desire train, but your meditation is just so pleasant that you don't even want to go there. Has anybody ever noticed that? Yeah. And it's actually, these are the same qualities in the mind. If you look at the Buddhist Abhidharma literature that talks about like the inner psychology, meditative psychology, these are factors, they don't only play in meditation. That's just where we see them the most with the greatest relief, right? So similarly, you know, if you're out on a great date with your partner, your best friend, or your new crush or whatever, you know, you're not thinking about eBay, right? You know, you're thinking about the quality of the wine and the twinkle in their eyes and this new silk shirt you've worn. And like, so a similar thing can happen with our meditation, you know. The old pattern of what I'm mad at, you know, which political candidate or whatever you want to get mad at, you know, starts to, hey, do you want to think about me? And you're like, no, dude, my breath. I'm meditating. Shh. But in the early stages, we have these. And so the classical antidotes for these hindrances are, if you tend to get sensory desire, they would say meditate on renunciation, which is sort of this thing about the various things that can go wrong in life and why it's not too good to get attached to being too excited, you know, all the time. And if you tend to get angry or aversive thoughts, you should meditate on loving kindness. And these have this effect of loving kindness sweetens the mind, and it has a cumulative effect of when you sit down, you tend to be just a little bit sweeter. And so those aversive thoughts can't get a foothold. And if you're thinking about, you know, somebody's sick friend and sort of the problems with cyclic existence, they would say in the old monastic terms, when you think about, oh, well, I could buy this or I could get this job, you're a little bit disillusioned by it, right? Now, the thing with these is that they are antidotes for a specific time. So a couple of the people here, one of these people who came over from Santa Cruz just graduated from a Chinese medical academy. Oh, wait, two of these, sorry. I think you're still a student. Anyway, two of these people just graduated with their master's as traditional Chinese medical therapists. And one of the things I used to teach at their university, and one of the things I like to tell new students, just to make sure we all knew, is that herbs are not always healthy, right? And you guys have learned this, right? So in traditional Chinese medicine, they have what are called superior herbs, which are kind of like just general health tonics. And then they have this lesser quality of herbs, which are, they have more side effects. And then there's a whole other quality that are actually poisons, but you can use them to treat certain disease states, right? And the thing to know, which if you're into holistic health and you have a friend who's kind of conventional doctor, they'll be sure to tell you right away is, well, holistic medicine's not always, herbs are not just healthy for you. There's all of these, and it's really true. You know, you can't just go around taking ginseng or astragalus root or things like that and not watch out for what does this do to people with blood pressure, high blood pressure? What does this do if you're on this kind of medication? Each herb is not for every situation. Similarly, each meditation antidote is not for every mental situation. Or conversely, we could say maybe there is a meditation antidote for each mental situation, right? So in these seven factors of awakening, the original version, as far as I've been taught and been able to find out, is these are aimed at specific states in your meditation practice, and how do we get to this state of calm abiding, right? In the Sanskrit, it's shamatha. I think in the Pali, it's samatha, right? This equal, steady, concentrated state of meditation, right? And so we're easing the mind. So now we get to where we are tonight. And the two meditation obstacles that you hear the most about, because a lot of the meditation literature is assuming that you are now a stage 3 or stage 4 meditator, right? You've seen through desire. You're like, okay, I'm still going to get my nice coffee that I like for after my meditation practice, but I know it doesn't bring me any lasting happiness. You know, and you've seen through anger, right? You know, I know that guy cut me off yesterday and then even shouted out the window after he cut me off. And yet, in my infinite cycle of births, I realized that was my mother or whatever, you know, or I'm never going to see that guy again and he's probably desperately unhappy and so I should just let it go. You know, like you've sat long enough that these things just slip off your duck's back like water, right? So now you hit two obstacles, the main meditation obstacles, which are called dullness and excitation, right? They translate them in different ways in different authors. One I saw translated it as sloth hyphen torpor. I was like, whoa, that's torpor. Goodness gracious. But I don't know, have any of you who have tried to meditate for a while, have you ever experienced a torpid meditation? All right, in. Right, and you're just gone, right? And it's not like, you know, it's not like whatever these Zen guys are saying, like, oh, gone beyond, body mind dropped. No, it's like, you know, did somebody slip me heroin or what? You know, like, how did this happen? Where am I? And then the other one, excitation, is when the mind just won't settle. Right? It just won't settle. And there are gross versions of these and there are subtle versions of these, right? So a lot of people have experienced gross torpidity, right? How about subtle torpidity? Can you think of a time, subtle torpidity? So they would say that this is where you've got the meditation object. You haven't forgotten the instructions. You're flowing along with the breath, and yet it's not bright in there. It's everything sort of just like kind of bland, and you know, you leave the meditation, you might feel tired at the end of the meditation, not like a good workout tired. That can be not a nice way to end the meditation, actually, but you're just kind of meh, right? Or subtle excitation. Again, you've got your meditation obstacle, but things are just a little jittery inside, right? So we've got gross and subtle versions of these. All of them precluded on the idea that you're keeping the meditation object somewhat regularly. Like I'm watching the breath, or I'm scanning the body, or visualizing, or whatever your object is. But there are these little, when you drop off the object for a few minutes, you're dropping into sleepiness, or you're dropping into chattiness, right? Can everybody relate to these two obstacles, right? We probably all have them to some degree. Would anybody say you are more dull than excited? Not more dull than exciting. Okay, I know you're all exciting. How about anybody who's more excited than dull? Okay, and then who's equal or don't know? Yeah, I think I might be equal. My morning meditations, I'm excited. My evening meditations, I'm dull. Sorry, I'm supposed to be the teacher. My meditations are great. I can. So let's start to learn about the antidotes for these states. One piece of good news before we get into the specifics of the antidotes is something that I don't hear a lot in meditation classes right now, but I'm very excited about. These antidotes work on the microcosm of meditation, but they also work in the same way on the macrocosm of the rest of your life. So, would anyone say that if you look at your day, if you look at your day, your standard day, do you ever have a quality of dullness that overwhelms your standard day? Everything, you know, kind of not, maybe not quite depressed. I mean, maybe classical Buddhism, they would count depression as a type of dullness. I'm not really sure. But, you know, not quite depressed, but just kind of, you can't rouse anything up about life. Have you ever noticed a day where excitation is the theme, right? You're going, you know, I watched on the internet this little trailer for a movie that's coming. I don't recommend you watch it unless you like kind of like naughty things, but I was enraptured, and it was called like Bad Moms or something like that, this movie that's coming out with these comedians in it. And the theory was, you know, that these moms get fed up. There were like expletives in the trailer. I didn't know you were allowed to just put trailers out with expletives on the internet, so this is why I'm warning you not to look it up if you don't like that kind of stuff. But the rest of it was funny. So anyway, the theory is, the premise is, these moms get fed up with like modern life as a mom and decide to just, you know, live a little and have some fun and not care what the PTA thinks or something. And this is a basis for a lot of jokes, I think. But as they're setting up the premise in this trailer, I'm looking at the comedic extremes they're going to make a mom's life look really hard. And I'm like, you know, that looks a lot like some moms I know. Like, it's actually more realistic than extreme, you know? And so she's trying to drink a latte while driving the car, and the kids are in back, and she's like dialing the phone, and like the dog is going to the vet. So the dog's in the front seat, and the two kids are in the back seat, and all the, and then the moms come up and sideline her, you know, to get her to go to the emergency PTA meeting tonight and blah, 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 blah. Right. And some of us are 7 days a week like that. Right? And so the mind is, you know, or if it's not going on in our external life, then it's going on in our internal life. We provide that for ourselves. So what's cool, and this, I don't hear a lot in other meditation classes, but I'm excited about it right now because it's sort of just become part of my awareness. The antidotes that you hear for those things in your meditation practice, in your seated formal 20 to 40 minutes or whatever, those same antidotes apply to if you have that factor too much in your waking life. So today we're talking about torpidity or sloth or dullness. And one of the antidote factors is joy, right? And we'll talk about a little about what that means in the classical context and then maybe what it means for us. But so here's this thing is research has shown that if you continually feel a little bit of dull, if you're on the verge of depression, and people working with a therapist who are actually diagnosed with depression, learning to cultivate joy can actually be the therapeutic intervention that snaps them out of that and gives them a sense of being able to go through the day. Okay, don't take this as medical advice. You online at home, this is not, talk to your doctor about joy. Side effects may include peacefulness, gratitude, equanimity. But it's really cool. It takes care of torpidity in meditation, but it also takes care of heaviness in the rest of our life to a certain degree. So this is kind of fun. So what is it, this joy that we're talking about? Did anybody, while we were meditating, and I asked you at the end, sort of take a little view of your mind and see, does your mind feel too low or too high or sort of just right? Did anybody notice, were you one or the other during our meditation? What do you think? Did anybody relate to that question? Which one were you? Too high. Okay, were anybody's sleepy town when you looked? Okay, one sleepy town. Anybody else too high in your meditation? It varied back and forth a little bit, yeah. And then everybody else was Goldilocks. Excellent, excellent. And then at the beginning of the meditation, I requested not to change your object. You know, we were going to work with watching the breath in, watching the breath out, but to change the quality of engagement on the object. So as the breath came in, how pleasant. And as the breath went out, how enjoyable. Did anybody relate to that? Did that work for anybody or not work for anybody? Worked for you? Tell me a little more.
It was a suggestion I'd never heard before. And I thought, you know, this is really nice to apply that level of, add a positive level of awareness to the simplicity of the breath.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. That's part of why I wanted to share that. So I'm glad that that was your experience. Yeah. What else, Edie?
I thought it was sort of a delicious, cool air.
Ooh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite tasty. What else? Did anybody else relate to that or not relate to that? Yes.
I found it actually helped me stay with the breath better.
Aha.
So that there was more sustained attention.
Yeah.
Yep. Which is surprising for me because I find myself having to come back.
Interesting.
And so I appreciated that instruction. I too have never heard it.
Mm.
And I can see how it's an antidote to, say, boredom or something.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So these are, thanks for that feedback. These are specific little methods that we can dip in to hack our meditation. Dave, something.
I follow the incense that I sometimes light at home when I meditate.
Mm-hmm.
How good it smells.
That's right. And it can just bring you into that present moment. Yeah. So this comes to me again. I too hadn't heard this in meditation instruction a lot until I took, over the summer, I took a course on yoga and positive psychology. Right, so it was a CEU course that psychologists and some massage therapists and yoga teachers were taking. And the teacher was talking, there's a discipline, in case you want to look it up, very interesting, called somatic experiencing. And one of the things that they do is called resourcing. And in resourcing, I'm not a somatic experiencing teacher, so if you look this up and it's different than what I've taught you, you can blame me, but this is what I got from the workshop I took. Basically, you are building up a sense of calm, peace, and positive emotions in your system, which, as we know, if you look into positive psychology at all, our resilience for trauma, for psychological stress, if you build up this sort of wellspring of calm and peace and gratitude and stuff, you're actually more resilient to the stressful things in your life. It's really cool, and there's quite a bit of research out about this now. So they make a practice of, like one thing you could do, find something enjoyable about your experience right now. Try it. So for me, the first thing that came to my mind was like, you don't have to go anywhere. I know exactly what I'm supposed to be doing, and it involves sitting in this chair, which is just really nice for me right now. You know, I don't have to wonder, oh, is something left? No, just sit here, teach the class, and it's very relaxing. There are nice people here, right? Let me hear two more. What was yours? Something enjoyable about your experience right now? Yes, Edie. Why, thank you. Okay, and one more? Something enjoyable? It's just fine, right? Yeah. So, but some of us will have a really hard time with this exercise because we're not actually trained that enjoyment is an important psychological trait to cultivate, right? Have any of you ever been sort of, has it been said to you that way? Enjoyment is an important psychological trait for you to cultivate. Like, I hadn't really ever heard this. You know, I heard you can fake it till you make it with some things. I've heard no pain, no gain. I've heard if you... did anybody ever see that old show, Fame? Right? It was like a dance college, you know, and the lady comes out, you want fame? Well, fame costs! And you're going to... You know, and she gave a real inspiring talk. And you don't see a show... really, where somebody comes out and says, you want psychological resiliency? Well, you're going to have to really learn to relax and relax hard and deep with a lot of comfort and ease. We're going to set the room temperature to 72 degrees and we're all going to have delicious filtered water in case you get thirsty. You know, like, who's ever heard of that? Nobody. And so similarly, when I saw that the topic was this factor of joy, I was like, that's cool, because that's exactly what has been the most revolutionary in my practice and in my teaching lately. So how many of you at some point in your meditation career sort of thought of meditation as something which might be kind of difficult or kind of boring? Has anybody ever, you know, like, oh yeah, well, I'd love to take up meditation, but I'm scared I'll get bored. Did anybody before you started practicing ever have this, you know, or sometimes you're established as a meditator and you're like, well, I'd love to practice today, but I'm scared I'll get bored. Because it can be, and like some of the Zen schools say it this way, like, your meditation should be very boring. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, he's a controversial Tibetan teacher, and he, which book was this in? I forget. I think it might have been in his book on spiritual materialism, but he talks about the Zen temple, right? Has anybody ever seen online or in person these Zen temples, right? And so, you know, it's got the hardwood floor and the shoji screens like at the sushi restaurant, and, you know, and we in the West oftentimes will go and we're like, oh, how exquisite, the Zen temple. And he says, in Japan, that's meant in, you know, 17th century Japan, that's supposed to be so boring. That's supposed to be like nothing special. So you go into the Zen temple and it's just shoji screens and a hardwood floor. There's no ornamentation. We go in and we think, oh, how simple, how wabi-sabi, very artistic. You know, but it's supposed to be just like nothing there. And so your mind gets very, very calm. But I think that for many of us, perhaps in the West, we're used to such a degree of stimulation that if you start meditating and the only instructions we get are, okay, now watch your breath, see it in an hour or something like that, it can be boring and we may not know exactly what to do if this quality of dullness creeps in. So if you feel bored in your meditation, that's a sign you've got subtle dullness, right? You're on your object. The meditation was okay, but it's kind of like, why am I doing this again? Or something like that. It's not fully engaged. So this is the first sort of way I'd like to encourage us to look at joy. Now this, it's an antidote, like you said, so it won't be that in every meditation you go in and oh, my breath in, ooh, oh, my breath out. And it's not necessarily that you're putting a lot of intentionality on that. But if the mind gets low, you can start to engage pleasure circuitry. And all of a sudden, the brain wakes up a little bit and the meditation becomes brighter. Does that make sense to everybody? Cool. Questions on that notion? No, pretty simple. So then where this relates to the macrocosm of our lives, which is really neat, is that if you were doing this and you were someone who sort of like this phase in your life, you felt a little glum most of the time or not quite excited, this type of pleasurable meditation would be a form of this resourcing practice that you used to gain more enjoyment in your life, right? So think about it. We tend to do in our meditation what our mind habitually does anyway. This is why they say another reason they say you need a teacher, so that they can see your blind spot for you. But we can, once we know the hacks, we can, you know, in the internet age, we can start to play with it ourselves a little bit. And this is one of these hacks. If throughout your life everything's kind of humdrum and then your meditation is kind of humdrum too, if you start to put a little pleasure, a little joy, a little rapture in your meditation, your life starts to become, you've created this resource that trickles out into the rest of your day. So it's really pretty neat. What do you think? Neat or not neat? Pretty neat. Okay, and totally doable. And then once you get that, once your mind is equal, they say, again, in Master Kamala Shila, I refer to him because I've been studying him the most recently, they say, then the last obstacle is actually applying antidotes when you don't need them. So you might hear, if there were another meditation teacher here, they might say, oh, no, don't add something into your meditation, you know, like a Zen teacher or some Vipassana teachers or something. You know, they say, don't start mixing stuff into the system. And that's not the idea. I agree. Don't mix stuff up. It's only when you're not actually doing the practice, right? The practice is to have a clear, present, alive awareness of the breath. So when that's not there, you're not doing it anyway. So the joy is to, how do you get alive, clear, present, and then you abide in that? Cool? Okay, so a little more on gross dullness, and then we'll do a little more on joy, and then we'll be out of time for the evening. Has anybody ever gone camping? Mm-hmm. Any campers in the room? Okay, so have you noticed that, especially if you went camping, you know, more than 10 years ago, before, you know, like everybody's got an iPad and a, you know, like the, some of the tents, they've got like electric light it's built into them now and stuff like that. So before all of this nonsense, you'll notice if you go camping, you generally go to sleep within about an hour after the sun goes down, right? You know, unless you're at some retreat where they're all banging drums by the fire, you know, sun goes down, you roast a marshmallow or two, and that's all you really got in you. Kumbaya is sung, and you're out, right? So one of the antidotes they say to, where's he going with this? One of the antidotes they say to gross dullness, which is where you literally actually start to fall asleep during your meditation, is that you're actually supposed to get more sleep. Okay. And so as I was driving here, I'm thinking, oh, what do I really want to share tonight? And one of the things that came to my mind is the monks who originally made this stuff up, it doesn't say so much in the books, go to bed if you experience gross dullness. And one of the reasons were that the original meditators in the Buddhist tradition camped out their entire life. These were people who wandered, and kings and princes would give them a special park. And then it was India, and they'd just sleep outside in their robes. So they were getting the 9.25 hours of sleep every day that is recommended for the brain growth of teenagers, right? You know, and then you adults are supposed to get about 8, I mean, give or take, but a lot of physicians agree that like that old 8 hours is really, it's actually true. And if we took you out into the woods and it wasn't Alaska in the summertime, you'd find you'd get 9 hours of sleep, you know, or 8 hours of sleep. You'd go to bed around 9 o'clock, and then your brain would pop you up at 5 o'clock or 5:30 when the sky starts to lighten. There's some early birds are getting worms, you know, and they're chirping. And then you'd hop out of bed and you'd meditate, and your mind would be not afflicted by subtle dullness. So this is, I think, just a special instruction for us. Once you've gotten enough sleep, the antidotes are, investigation, persistence, and joy. But if you haven't gotten enough sleep, the antidotes are get adequate rest in addition to meditating. And it's absolutely amazing. Okay, so a little more on joy. The Pali word is pitti. So everybody sees, please say pitti. And the Sanskrit is pritti. So if you want to, you can say pritti. Which you have to curl your tongue back to make that r. I believe it's a retroflex r. I didn't look up the Sanskrit, but it looked like it. So pritti. Yeah. And this is, there are two meanings of this. So one is a mental factor that you can use in meditation. So we already experimented with how to do that. Another is something that happens on its own in meditation. So has anybody here, maybe today or maybe in a different sitting period, during your meditation felt a rapturous or blissful feeling come over your body and mind? Couple of nods. Okay. Good. So that actually is a pretty darn good sign. And it was so popular in the old days in the Mahayana traditions where they say you're supposed to be compassionate to living beings and stuff like that. They actually made a rule for these practitioners that said, don't get too attached to the blissful feelings of meditation, you know, because they were afraid they'd just sit on their butt all day, you know, blissing out instead of going out and cleaning up the trash on the road or something like that. I don't know. So the other way we can sort of use this joy is in when we're talking less about obstacles, joy is one of the mental factors that starts to elevate your meditation practice from a pretty decent meditation into an even, you could say higher or deeper, you know, into an even more groovy meditation practice. So and it all starts out in the same way. So I want to give you my sort of my take on meditation of breathing, and then we'll tie this all together because we're almost at the end of our time together. So for a long time, I just didn't get the mindfulness of breathing as a meditation object. I would sit down and they'd go, okay, now be aware of your breathing. And I would just think for an hour straight, because I'm a very creative and inspired person. And so I just gave up on any meditation teachers that told me to sit down and be aware of my breath, right? It just wasn't going to work for me. And I actually found that I did personally do better with like Taoist meditations where you visualize things in different centers in your body, you know, so they would say visualize a light down here in your belly. And for some reason that actually made my mind quieter than focusing on my breath. It was cool that I found that stuff. But I always had in me, like I felt a little like I wasn't quite up to par with the meditators who could sit down and just focus on their breath. And I took a teaching with a meditation teacher, and he was talking about how in relating to his teacher, he was trying to accurately translate a particular word. He was relating to a Tibetan teacher. But again, the meditation instructions are pretty much the same from Thailand to Tibet to China, you know. So you'll hear this word they call placement of the mind, right? Have you heard this? If you come to a meditation, oh, please place your mind on the breath, right? Or sometimes they'll say, rest the mind on the breath or something like that. But it seems that we try to wrestle the mind onto the breath, or we try to like stick the mind on the breath. And what happens is that we then add all this other tension to a process that's supposed to be alleviating of tension. Some people who've been into meditation for a while, you'll hear there's this old Buddhist analogy of the two darts in emotional experiences, right? So one is, let's say, you know, you got rear-ended on Highway 880. God forbid that ever happens to you. But let's say, you know, hypothetically. And so there's this sort of physical jerk, right? And then there is this adrenal squeeze, right? So you have all these body sensations. You know, don't deny that your heart is going to go like that. And, oh, no, don't emote. You know, that's really happening. And your thoughts will probably speed up and all of this stuff happens. But then a split second later, we then go, oh, God, I'm so stupid. I should have been looking in the rearview mirror. Or we say, this jerk, why didn't you watch where you were going? Or we say, oh, this always happens to me. I have such bad luck. Or the drivers these days, I should have moved out of the Bay Area 15 years ago. Have you heard your mind say something like this in various situations, right? So they would say the physical thing that happened, the getting rear-ended, is one dart. You got hit by that dart. There's no way around it. But there's a second one coming, which is the suffering you can inflict from your own mind, right? And that one is optional. So similarly, when we come to meditation, there's an event happening there. So the meditation event isn't necessarily suffering, but by the stories that we bring to it, of whether it has to be arduous or it has to be this, or it's going to determine how much fun or not fun that is. And I imagine you'll hear something about this when you learn about the obstacle of excitation, which the next set of antidotes are for in these seven. And if you don't hear about it, you can come to my class, which doesn't conflict with the times of these classes, so I don't feel like I'm cheating when I say that, which is on May 22nd. I'll tell you about it later. But one of these things is that I think a lot of us, when we say place the mind, we add in struggle to wrestle to put the mind on the breath and come back to the breath. And you got to sit for the whole 40 minutes and not move or whatever it is. And when in fact it could be this enjoyable, beautiful experience, like, guess what? You don't have to do anything but think about your breath. And you get to do it for 40 whole minutes. Wow. And I imagine if we brought that to meditation, there'd be a whole other thing that spun out from that beginning, right? So the word in Sanskrit is, the root word is da, which means to place. It actually comes through into the words we have for a deed of a house, or to go do a deed of great valor or something like that. This is this word. It means to set down, right? And then the other word for meditation, if you're into the Buddhist stuff in the Noble Eightfold Path, is sama, right? So it's called samadhi, right? And sama means equal or like in balance, complete. So when we meditate, it means setting the mind down equally. Right. And so what happens is that if we start by joyfully, calmly, sort of pleasantly setting the mind down, we can more rapidly get into these states where there's a rapturous, blissful feeling that rises up in us. Right. And what's wonderful is the thing that I've noticed in studying a little bit of this sort of psychology of joy, psychology of meditation, the reason our minds veer from the breath is that we feel stressed out. We feel unpleasant feelings. It's not that we're not trying hard enough. It's that we're too keyed up inside. And in fact, if you have a resource of joy built up, a resource of pleasant feelings, you can sit down and the mind goes, oh, how nice, nothing to do but sit with the breath. So we can use this. This is the main point I hope to get across, is that we can use this feeling of pleasure, not sensual desire that we already let go of, but this intrinsic, endogenous, kind of relaxed, satisfied perkiness. We can use this as a way to actually train our meditation, rather than our meditation being neutral or, you know, some of these other things that I think we bring in, and it actually turns the mind off a little bit. We can find this perkiness that keeps us from falling in to these dull states of awareness. So when you do this, you can actually start to see the continuum, that it starts with a type of joyfulness. And the more relaxed we are with the breath, the body starts to produce more joy. So this is the second meaning of the term in the Pali and the Sanskrit. You'll see it in two places. One is a technique that you use, and the other is kind of how you gauge where your meditation is. So if you sit and you're on the breath, for me, I've experienced this more and more lately. It's quite enjoyable. You know, and you get about 15 minutes in, and then all of a sudden, I may have started the meditation going like, oh gosh, do I have 30 minutes to actually do this? I don't know. Okay, well, I'm going to sit. I'm going to set my timer, you know, and then the timer goes off. I'm like, oh, do I have to? Do I have to get up? I really don't want to. Because there's some subtle quality that starts to suffuse the body and mind. And this, if we do it right, I think it makes a big circle. You know, if you get enough of that, you're going to get on the meditation cushion. You're going to relax into your breath. And it becomes a technique of its own. You can relax into this feeling of joy, and it starts to carry the meditation like you're gliding along. So we have just a couple minutes left, and I put a bunch of ideas out there, and I'd love to give us maybe just a chance if there are any questions or things that need to be rounded out that didn't quite, that I glossed over on accident. If you have any questions, let's make time for them now. Or anything to add?
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.